Inmates in Utah die at a higher rate than any state in the country. Let me say that again. Here in Utah, inmates die at a higher rate than any state in the country. Is it significantly higher than other states, the death rate? Not necessarily, but still, there were 11 deaths in Utah's jail system in 2012. Last year, by July, there were already 26. And why? What is it about Utah, about the system? Well, we don't really know, and one of the reasons is because the rules that jails operate under, they're secret. They're not available to the public. This is More to Say. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For several months now, KUER's Whitney Evans has been following this story, and she's with me to talk about it. Whitney, hi.
Hi, Doug.
So how did you find this story?
I'd been following up on a number of stories about people who were dying in jails. And it seemed like it was happening more and more often. And the deaths were really, really tragic. People were dying because they were dehydrating and bleeding out. And I was thinking to myself, how could this be happening? How is this possible? And it just so happens that the Standard Examiner had been asking that question as well. So I was following up on some of their reporting and realized that there was really no way to find out how inmates were being treated, if they were being treated well enough, and if they came into jail, if the jails were essentially had adequate training to deal with people who were sick, who were hurt. So that's when I started to look into jail policies.
So part of the coverage was because it's so hard to find that stuff out, as you learned. One of the things you did was talk to the families of the inmates who died. Tell us about Madison.
Madison, the story was really familiar to me as someone who's from a rural part of the country. This family spends a lot of their time outside. They love horses. They love hunting. They love riding four-wheelers. And they also live in a part of Utah that doesn't have a lot of resources for someone who's going through some sort of mental health crisis. And it just so happens that's what was happening with Madison Jensen. She was 21 years old. Her mom had just gone in for surgery. The doctor said, you know, if she's under too much stress, it could cost her life. Madison was feeling suicidal. She'd recently experimented with drugs. And she and her father, who were very, very close, they decided together that the best option would be to send her to jail where Madison could be watched closely. They hoped anyway. So because there is not a place to send someone in Roosevelt, Utah, on a weekend, Madison went to jail.
Yeah.
And they were able to send her to jail because they sort of dug around and tried to find some drug paraphernalia that she'd had. So they looked for a reason to put her in jail. Jared Jensen, Madison's father, said she decided for the safety and the health of her mother to willingly put her in jail. And it actually took a long conversation between the family and the officer who showed up at the house. But they finally decided that that was going to be the best option.
The conversation you had with her father, it's pretty...
It's a strange thing, you know.
Tragic.
And she was the one that whatever dad wanted to do, she was in your back pocket. Whenever we would go duck hunting, fishing, she was going. She was the outdoors 100% through and through. She always wanted to be self-sufficient. She never asked really for nothing from us except for college tuition, if we could help her, in which she earned that by working the cattle and having a cattle ranch. That girl is so tough. For people out there listening, she got hit by lightning 5 years ago and lived. Her acrylic nails were boiled. Her arms was swelled up. She smelled like a barbecue, and she lived through that. For 2 weeks after that, she would sleep between my wife and I, And we would just hold our hand on her to make sure she is breathing. She recovered from that, and then she was involved in an accident with her mom where there was a high-speed chase in Weber County, and the person they was pursuing passed through the intersection, and another vehicle didn't yield for the red light, and the cop hit that car and pushed that car into my wife's along with the police officer's car. And they were at the stoplight parked and knocked them 50 foot backwards. She lived through that one. And then 2 years later, she was dodging cows, of course it's cows, on the road. And it wasn't when she overcorrected, but the side of the road was soft and took her and her sister and put both them into the windshield and ripped the whole front end off of the truck and everything, and she lived through that.
She survived all of those things. And he watched his daughter just power through all of these really difficult times in her life and still suffer the consequences of all of those things, mentally and physically. And yet all it took was just a couple of days behind bars for her to die. She'd been on several different medications that were prescribed to her. Not to mention she had tried heroin, she said. I'm not sure how much heroin she'd actually done. But her father said, Madison said she'd tried heroin once or twice. When she got to jail, they took her off all of her medication. So she was off of her medication for a couple of days, and then they brought one or two medications back. In that process, she had some kind of reaction. That led to her having violent bouts of diarrhea and vomiting. She couldn't keep any liquids down. She had a roommate in her cell. Her roommate complained, asked for help, called for help repeatedly. Madison was just losing all of her body fluids. By the time she died, she lost more than 18 pounds. There's some confusion as to how much weight she actually lost, but it was a lot of weight. It was more weight than I even thought someone could lose in the span of 3 days. And Madison Jensen's father just is in complete disbelief that what could have saved her life was an IV bag. It could have been prevented.
So, because it's hard to find out what the standards are like, do you have any hunches about what's going on? Is it about officers using excessive force? Are there any common characteristics as you're trying to put this together?
Talking to families and looking at the stories, words that keep coming up are indifference, callousness, reckless disregard. But another thing is that jails are being, as we saw in Madison's case, jails are being sort of used as de facto emergency rooms for people who are in really desperate times in their lives. You know, either they're withdrawing from drugs or they just had some sort of issue with their mental health that caused them to act out in a way that led to them being arrested. So these people are in crisis and they're being put in jails, and we don't know whether they're being taken care of. We don't know if they have the resources. We don't know if they have the knowledge and education. And we don't know if these people, we don't know if the people who are running the jails are compassionate toward these inmates.
But that doesn't make any sense. These are public agencies. How is it that these jail standards can remain a secret? How is it that the state or any of these agencies, how are they able to keep this stuff a secret?
That's a really good question. And when you look at other states, which I've done, other states post these standards online. You can go online and look at these standards. Anyone can access these standards, whether it be prison or jails. You can't access these standards in the state of Utah, nor can you access the reports from the annual inspections. And it just so happens that the organization that does the annual inspections is the Utah Sheriff's Association, which is basically a nonprofit, a union, as much as Utah can have a union for Utah sheriffs. They pay dues every year, and they participate in this voluntary program where the Utah Sheriff's Association comes in and does an inspection of jails using the standards that the state of Utah has and performs these inspections, but no one is allowed to see those inspections either. I've asked for the inspections. I've asked for the standards in pretty much every single county in the state of Utah that has a jail. And what I've gotten back is that these standards are proprietary, and so are the inspection reports.
Okay, so this gets us to the main character in your story, really. It's a man named Gary DeLand. Tell us who he is and how he fits into all of this, because he's kind of the go-to guy.
Gary DeLand is the go-to guy in the state of Utah for all things corrections. I've heard someone say, Gary DeLand knows more about corrections than anyone in this country, alive or dead. He used to be head of Utah prisons in the 80s and early 90s, and he left the public sector basically to become a consultant. He writes jail standards and prison standards. He trains people who work in jails and prisons, and he does this for a price all across the country. So the standards being used in Utah are also being used in at least 18 other states.
One of the things you mentioned in your reporting is that what makes DeLand's insight so valuable to other people is that he's been sued plenty of times, and so he knows how to work within the system.
You name it. It's everything from very serious things, such as in custody death, use of force, those kinds of issues, down to you had chunky peanut butter instead of smooth. When I ran the Department of Corrections, I was sued for that. I was sued for stealing brainwaves. Those all got me into the courtroom.
The whole point of this, the whole point of Gary DeLand creating these standards and selling these standards, is to protect sheriffs, to protect jails from lawsuits in situations like what happened with Madison Jensen.
A lot of the sheriffs didn't want standards because they said, as soon as you have standards, even though they're technically not legally binding, attorneys, media, others would say, oh, you violated this one, you violated that one. And we don't want that. So the early inspections we did, the sheriffs would shred the, not all, but some of the sheriffs would shred the report after they got it. Say, okay, here are the things we got to do, but I don't want that report laying around. Somebody can use it against us.
He considers them to be legal based on the law, not based on policies that lawmakers create or policies that the ACLU creates, not at all. He says he bases these standards on the law, and he updates these standards, so he says, regularly based on court rulings.
Yeah.
So when you go to court, you argue over something like chain gangs, for instance, then he updates the standards to reflect court rulings as they happen.
So he goes in, updates them from time to time, but importantly and significantly for your story, he keeps this stuff to himself because he can sell it to others. It wouldn't make any sense for him to just put it online and make it available to everybody else because he's making money.
That's his bread and butter. That's his business.
Yeah.
And like he said, you know, he admits it's a selfish reason, but he says, you know, Pepsi doesn't give up its ingredients to Coke. Mm-hmm.
So what's the next part for you in terms of your coverage of this?
Following what lawmakers are doing and seeing how interested lawmakers are in following this issue as well. It may just be me. It may just be the standard examiner. It may just be the ACLU that's worried about this and that's interested in this. But it sounds like there's some interest on the Hill. How far lawmakers are willing to go to get a hold of these standards is anybody's guess.
That's KUER's Whitney Evans. Whitney, thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
More to Say is a production of KUER News. Doug Fabrizio is our host, and Lee Hale and Tim Slover produced the show. You can subscribe to More to Say wherever you get your podcasts, and thanks for sharing the program.